Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Dialogue and the Petrine Ministry. The president of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, Cardinal Walter Kasper, examines the hurdles that must be overcome by all sides for progress in ecumenical dialogue. The week of prayer for Christian unity ends on the feast of the conversion of St. Paul. Who was that apostle, and where is he buried in Rome? And crosses on fire and churches under siege. A new report accuses Burma's military regime of trying to wipe out Christianity in the South Asian country. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Those are the stories we'll be looking at today over the next half hour. Thanks for joining me. There's no turning back on the road to promoting Christian unity. In a Vatican press conference Tuesday, the president of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Unity Among Christians, Cardinal Walter Kasper, said that although Christian churches have not yet found that unity, they have established a solid network of relationships and dialogue to help them along the way to achieving that ultimate goal. One of the difficult issues in the conversation has been questions concerning the Petrine Ministry. On his recent visit to the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew I in Turkey, Pope Benedict reiterated Pope John Paul's request to church leaders to help him find a way in which this ministry can be acceptable to all the churches. We asked Cardinal Kasper, what has the response been to that request?
We had many responses, especially from Western churches, and we responded to them again. And we had a symposium with the theologians of the Eastern or the Orthodox churches, theologians which were mandated by the synods and patriarchs. And now we will approach this question in the next plenary of our common international theological commission in Ravenna in October. Otherwise, this will be a long discussion because it's not only a theological problem in an academic sense, it's also emotional portion. Emotional from our Catholic side because, of course, we are very proud, we are very happy to have this Petrine Ministry. It gives a common point of reference to our church and makes a high degree of visibility of the church. But it's also an emotional problem from the other side. There are many emotions against it, very bad memories also. And so also purification of memories is required. And so step by step, but we have already a network now. The patriarchs come to us, the Pope goes to the patriarchs. There are many visits of Catholic bishops to the Orthodox churches. The Orthodox churches are living today also among us. They are in the States, they are in Canada, they are in Europe, everywhere. And this creates a new atmosphere and better knowledge, because often the reason for divisions is we do not know the other very much, and therefore we are afraid about the other. And so we must know each other, must talk with each other, and especially pray with each other.
Cardinal Walter Kasper is the president of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity. The Feast of the Conversion of St. Paul, January 25th, marks the end of the week of prayer for Christian unity. Ecumenical celebrations on that day are traditionally held each year at the Rome Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls, not far west from the Vatican. Well, centuries ago, the original basilica was built over the tomb of the Apostle Paul. While Peter's burial place can be seen underneath St. Peter's Basilica, the Apostle Paul's had been hidden from view. But after recent excavations beneath St. Paul's Basilica, pilgrims can finally catch a glimpse of the apostles' tomb. The rough-hewn marble sarcophagus dates back to the time of Constantine in the 4th century and has been buried in concrete and under tons of rubble beneath the basilica. Well, I asked Professor of Christian Art and Architecture Elizabeth Lev why the Basilica of St. Paul's is called Outside the Walls and how Paul came to live and die here in Rome.
Because the name of the church comes from the fact that the basilica is built outside of the ancient Roman city walls. In 271, Rome had a series, today you can still see this intact series of walls, which spans an 11-mile circuit. The Rome of Paul's age in the 60s was an even smaller circuit of walls. And the Church of St. Paul, when it was eventually built by Constantine, was built outside the city walls on the site where St. Paul had been buried, and so it's referred to as the Church of St. Paul outside the walls, whereas there are churches to St. Paul within the city walls.
It's quite symbolic, too, it seems to me, that both St. Peter's and St. Paul's are on the same side of the Tiber River.
In both cases, I think even more interesting is the way they are spread directly opposite from each other. So if the Romans always construct their cities with what they call the Cardo and the Decumanus, these are two main roads, so they're the lifeline, and there's this intersection between the two roads. The churches of St. Peter and St. Paul, they make really the Cardo of Rome, the two balances that define and shape the city. And so it is a very interesting aspect of the construction.
Now, why would St. Paul's bones have been buried there? What kind of a life did he have in Rome? We know the story, especially from Caravaggio's painting in Santa Maria del Popolo, of St. Paul on the road to Damascus, who is blinded by the revelation of God. Tell us more about the life of St. Paul and how he must have lived here in Rome.
Well, St. Paul's conversion was extraordinary in every way. He went from being one of the harshest persecutors of Christians. He was a Jew. He was also a Roman citizen, though, by nature of his birth. He was freeborn as a Roman citizen, which will give him opportunities and possibilities which will not be available to St. Peter, who is not a Roman citizen. And St. Paul started our first mention of Paul is with his earlier name of Saul, persecutor of Christians, eager to go to Damascus to bring other Christians for punishment and persecution. And God's interruption in his life, Christ's revelation to him in Saul, why do you persecute me? Blinded, helped, assisted, reborn, if you will, he becomes Paul, and he travels all over the Mideast. He goes up through the Hellenistic world. He goes to Greece. He goes to Anatolia. He goes from place to place, forming these pockets of Christians, and then he comes to Rome. And he comes to Rome as a prisoner, because when Paul was brought up for trial, when he was condemned, Paul, as a Roman citizen, had the right of appeal directly to the Roman emperor, which is exactly what plays right into the hands of the Christian plan to bring Christianity to Rome. So Paul was brought to Rome. At the time, according to the legends, the Emperor Nero was not overly interested in the problem of the Christians yet. And so Paul lived in a kind of house arrest in rented rooms for about 2 years, during which time he was able to freely communicate, evangelize, preach. Whether or not he took trips from Rome, things start to get shaky. So we know that Paul lived, he lived at least 2 years here in Rome, because it's in the Acts of the Apostles. There are a number of different areas in Rome that claim, you know, Paul slept here, but we know he lived in rented lodgings, and that Paul was able to, from Rome, he wrote several of his letters, and of course before he came to Rome, he wrote the longest of his letters, which is the letter to the Romans.
Am I correct in recalling that there is a site in the Roman Forum that used to be a prison, and some of the apostles were held there.
Paul's life here in Rome, gradually the net grew closer as Nero's madness grew deeper. The catalyst, according to tradition, was the Great Fire of Rome. And tradition has it that...
Which was in the, what, 50s?
64 AD, there was the Great Fire of Rome, which knocked out 10 of the 14 quarters of the city. The rumors that flew at the time were that Nero himself had set the fire because he wanted to build in the area. But Nero turned around and blamed the Christians for the fire. And this is documented. Tacitus tells us that the fire was, that Nero claimed the fire was set by these pernicious Christians, this Jewish cult that followed a man named Crestos. So we see that the Christians are really they're in line for the first major persecution in Rome. Now, the tradition is that St. Peter and St. Paul were both in Rome in 64. As a matter of fact, we think that Paul came to Rome somewhere 60, 62, and that Peter had already been in Rome for many years after he left Antioch. And so that Peter and Paul were rounded up in the repercussions for the fire, and they were put in prison together, in the political prison right off the Forum, known as the Mamertine Prison. Whether or not that is true or can be archaeologically supported is a whole different question. But what is very, very beautiful, and one of the most lovely things, I think you know this because you and I have both lived in Rome for quite a long time, is June 29th, which celebrates the day that the two apostles were taken from their prison. So many paintings of the two embracing for one last time, and Peter marched in the direction that would later become St. Peter's, and St. Paul marched over towards the sea, and he would be executed at the site of the Tre Fontane, which still has a monastery and church on it. And
the Three Fountains.
The Three Fountains.
Why is it called the Three Fountains?
It's a legend. These wonderful legends around the deaths of the apostles, particularly Paul, has a series of magnificent legends surrounding his death. That the head of Paul was beheaded. It's his right as a Roman citizen as well to a swift death, as opposed to Peter, who was going to be crucified. And that Paul was led out. He was bent down, he was beheaded, and his head, when severed, bounced three times. In each place his head bounced, a fountain sprung up. And so this is the site of the Three Fountains.
Which is an actual church now.
Which is today an actual church on the Laurentina with three fountains, which have mosaic flooring from an earlier period than when Paul died. But it's still a beautiful place to go and a wonderful place to remember the witness of Paul. And then the body of Paul was taken a few kilometers down, a little ways down, to where the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls is today. Although a section of the skull was removed at some point, again, in the very early era of the relics, you know that the bodies of the apostles were moved around a bit because of persecutions, because of later date, because of other problems. So, for example, in the Catacombs of St. Sebastian, there's the Room of the Apostles where Peter and Paul were allegedly kept together. Their remains were kept together in a safer place. And in the Church of St. John Lateran, the huge reliquary over the main altar, the papal altar of St. John Lateran, the reliquary contains a piece of the skull of Peter and a piece of the skull of Paul. But I trust the rest of Paul will be in the sarcophagus. Mm-hmm. You know that the description of the grave of St. Peter comes from a man named Caius, who left us a written description of the grave of St. Peter and says he saw the tombs of St. Peter and St. Paul. And so it's good to know that there is a document. There's a document that dates from about 200 AD, and he was writing an apologetics, a kind of defensive letter. And in the midst of it, he says, "I can show you the trophies of St. Peter and St. Paul." So we know in 200, before Christianity is legalized, before they're building churches, we already have a document that testifies to veneration of the relics of the martyrs, one out by the Tre Fontane, out by the Ostiense road, and the other one on the Vatican Hill.
Elizabeth Lev is a professor of Christian art and architecture for Duquesne University's Rome campus. Mountaintop crosses torn down and burned, churches under siege, soldiers encouraged to marry Christian women in forced conversions. Those are just some of the things happening in Christian villages in Burma. Human rights groups accuse the military regime in Burma of trying to wipe out Christianity, about 6% of the population in the mostly Buddhist country. The military junta has been accused of committing widespread human rights abuses since it took power in 1988. The abuses have landed in the international spotlight, largely thanks to Nobel Prize-winning Aung San Suu Kyi, for years under arrest for leading peaceful opposition to the regime. Now, according to Christian Solidarity Worldwide, the military junta is enacting a village-by-village plan to impose the state religion, Buddhism, on everyone. They say an apparently government-approved document called Program to Destroy the Christian Religion in Burma has been circulating throughout the country, detailing ways to implement the plan. Christian Solidarity Worldwide's advocacy officer for South Asia, Benedict Rogers, has recently returned from Burma and has compiled a report of abuses against the small Christian communities there. It's called Carrying the Cross, the military regime's campaign of restriction, discrimination, and persecution against Christians in Burma. I asked him what led him to make such damning accusations against the military regime.
I was surprised myself to find myself reaching that conclusion, but through the process of extensive research over the last year, both in terms of the physical attacks on Christians in various parts of Burma and in terms of the some of the statements that have come out from the regime, I think it is very clear that the regime has a very strong anti-Christian agenda. It's important to stress, though, that manifests itself in different ways. And in some parts of the country, it's much, much more subtle. And you could go to parts of the country and see churches worshipping openly and not think there was a problem. So it's subtle in some areas. It's outright physical destruction in other areas.
First of all, let me ask, how many Christians are there in Burma, and are they concentrated in one or more areas?
It's very difficult to have an accurate figure because there hasn't been a population census for many years. But they are largely concentrated among the ethnic minority groups, the Karen, the Kareni, the Chin, the Kuchin, and the Naga. In particular, the ethnic minorities in total amount to about 40% of the population, and it's possibly safe to say about 10% are Christian. So it's roughly 10% of the population are Christian.
Now, when you say that you were surprised by some of your findings, what exactly surprised you about them, and where were you getting your information about this campaign against Christians?
The reason I was surprised was that all the people of Burma are suffering, Buddhists and Muslims as well, and I had previously not appreciated the extent of the anti-Christian dimension to the regime's behavior. But it was very clear from the evidence I found that, for example, when they attack Karen ethnic villages, they very often will, when I say they, the military very often will single out the church, and they'll leave the Buddhist monastery standing, but they'll burn down the church. And there are a number of explicit statements from the regime, including a document that has been widely circulated that is believed to have come from the Ministry of Religious Affairs, or at least with the approval of the Ministry of Religious Affairs. But of course, the ministry would deny that. But it's a document that is headlined Programme for the Destruction of Christianity, and it's 17 points. It actually begins, "There shall be no home where the Christian religion is practiced." Now, that's the rhetoric of the regime. In practice, there is a degree of religious freedom. Churches can function and can worship, but they are restricted. So, but I was surprised by how much evidence there was of this, which I hadn't previously appreciated.
Just on the validity of this document that you say was perhaps promulgated by the Religious Affairs Department of the government, what leads you to believe that that is an official document?
Well, it has come to me from multiple sources, several sources independently of each other, and I actually have the Burmese version of the document. And the document is actually headed, with a Buddhist name at the top, but underneath it, it says Ministry of Religious Affairs. We have tried to go through diplomatic channels privately to contact the Ministry of Religious Affairs to get their response, and they of course deny it. But in a sense, you know, they probably would deny it. They have done nothing publicly to contradict the statement, and so the fact that the document says Ministry of Religious Affairs on it, and the ministry has done nothing to counter it, suggests that it did have, at the very least, the ministry's blessing. If it wasn't actually directly written by the ministry, it was certainly written by an organization closely associated with the ministry.
Why did you choose the title that you chose for this report?
I think for a number of reasons. One of the most physically striking dimensions to this whole issue, because as I say, in some parts of the country, it's a very subtle phenomenon. But one of the most striking explicit aspects is in Chin and to some extent in Kuchin state, the physical destruction of crosses, the forcing of Christians to tear down their own crosses. And I think carrying the cross is what that's what Christians have been called to do throughout the centuries, and it's a good description of what persecution amounts to. But the striking symbolism of actually Christians in Burma being forced to tear down their crosses is that's the main reason I chose that title.
It's a very odd dichotomy there between people being able to freely practice their Christian religion and others then being told they're not allowed to practice at all at home or openly in public.
Well, it is very odd and it's quite a confusing situation. Churches can function pretty much in all parts of the country, but they are heavily restricted, so it's almost impossible to build a new church, and it's also almost impossible to extend or renovate an existing church or to build other church buildings, a church function hall or that sort of thing. It's also very difficult to get permission to hold church meetings other than your Sunday service. In some parts of the country, Christians are also physically attacked and churches have been burnt down. And particularly in Chin state, crosses which the Chin Christians put on mountaintops have been destroyed. And very often the military will force Chin Christians to pull down a cross and build a Buddhist pagoda in its place. So using Christian forced labor to build Buddhist monuments. But it is certainly confusing that on the one hand there's this document ordering the destruction of Christianity, but on the other hand it is not like some other countries where Christianity is entirely underground. Churches do function, so it is a complex situation. I can only think that the regime allows some degree of religious freedom in order to try and create the impression that they allow some freedom, but underneath it all, that freedom is extremely restricted, and in many places, people are physically persecuted as well as restricted and discriminated against. It's also important to say that Christians in government service are denied promotion. There's a glass ceiling beyond which Christians cannot rise. And in Qin State, there was a statement from the regime describing the three biggest threat to society as ABC. A was HIV/AIDS, B was hepatitis B, and C was Christianity. So that seems to be how the regime views Christianity.
But why is that? Have Christians in any way in the past been viewed as more vocal in opposing the regime? Why would the Christian community be considered a threat?
I think it's a combination of factors. I think the regime is very steeped in a sort of perverted form of Buddhist nationalism. It has nothing to do with real teachings of Buddhism, but a real belief that to be Burmese, you should be Buddhist. So it's intolerant of anything other than their version of Buddhism. Secondly, Christians tend to be very often quite educated and quite active in positions of leadership, particularly in the ethnic minority groups. And so that makes them stand out. And also, I think, a belief on the part of the regime that Christianity is a colonial legacy and that Christians are unpatriotic and sort of a hangover from the Western colonial past.
How has this campaign against Christians then been perceived by non-Christians in Burma?
Well, all of the non-Christians that I speak to, you know, outside the regime, completely agree that this campaign exists. And in fact, the original request to do this report, I was actually quite reluctant to do the report because I didn't want to single out one group above others. But the request to do it came actually from two Burma campaigning organizations that are not Christian-based organizations at all. So when they asked me to do it, I felt I really should look at it. I think it would also be important to stress that there will be a statement in response to our report from both the exiled government, the National Coalition Government of the Union of Burma, which is the pro-democracy umbrella movement, which is primarily comprised of Buddhists. It's not an explicitly Buddhist organization, but most of the people in it are Buddhist. They're going to issue a statement welcoming our report. And the Rohingya Muslim population are also going to be issuing a statement strongly welcoming our report. So it's important to emphasize that this report follows reports that have already come out on the imprisonment of Buddhist monks and on the persecution of Muslims, and that all the people of Burma outside the regime seem to be pretty supportive of what we're doing in that context.
Christian Solidarity Worldwide's advocacy officer for South Asia, Benedict Rogers. For more information about this story and the work of this human rights organization, log on to Christian Solidarity Worldwide's website. That's www.csw.org.uk. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.